Hey, Kev, let's follow this trail over here. This looks like there might be something waiting down there.
All right. Hey, wait a minute. Do you hear that?
Yeah, I thought it was just me. What the heck is that?
I don't know what that is. Whoa, do you smell that, too?
That's unbelievable. Hey, look.
What the?
Hey, look, those branches are moving over there.
What the heck is that?
Holy cow, is that what I think it is? Look at that thing.
Oh my god.
It's a freaking Sasquatch.
Welcome to the Bigfoot Terror in the Woods Sightings and Encounters podcast. I am your host, W.J. Sheehan, author of the series of books, Bigfoot Terror in the Woods, Sightings and Encounters, 11 volumes available in paperback, ebook, and audio format at Audible, Amazon, and iTunes. So please take advantage of a copy or two, show some support for the show. And by the way, I just wrapped up the review of the Volume 11 audiobook, kicked it back to my sound engineer, so that should be being launched shortly. Of course, I'll tell you, but keep your eyes out for it. You may know about it before I tell you. And now, without any further ado, may I introduce you to my brother and my co-host, KJ Sheehan. Kev, how are you?
I'm doing great, Bill. How about you?
Pretty good. I should add that Volume 12 in paperback is done, except for the cover art. So as soon as that gets wrapped up, that bad boy is going to be launched, and I'll start recording that as well.
Well, I bought a 64-color box of Crayola crayons today. So
nice.
I should be done with the artwork soon.
Good. Good. And well,
the hardest part is getting the crayon.
We'll hope for the best. Do they still give you a sharpener in the box for the crayons?
Oh, you need it. You need a sharpener. That's why you have to go for the 64 count.
Yeah. And
the smaller counts don't come with the sharpener.
That's right. Right. The little boxes you get ripped off.
You get ripped off. You get the crayons, no sharpener. Come on. What are you going to do?
You know, and they always give you all of those colors, but the ones that are most common, you kind of beat them up and use them up, and then you're like, ah, these crayons aren't any good anymore.
So you're saying you don't, like, do a lot with burnt sienna?
Well, you know, Bob Ross used a lot of burnt sienna.
He did?
Yeah.
I think because he started out with Crayola.
Cerulean blue, burnt sienna.
Maybe he was like a shareholder.
He had a stake in burnt sienna.
Titanium white.
Yeah, that was another one. Titanium white.
I'm channeling Bob Ross.
That's right. Remember, it's your lake. Do with it what you want.
It's a happy tree. But unfortunately, it gets kind of close to, why don't you let me in? I just want to use your telephone.
Ah. Well,
you think Bob Ross was black-eyed, one of the members of the Black-Eyed Children?
He might have been. He might have been with that voice. You know, if I could do a redo of Bob Ross, I would do it in kind of a psycho fashion. For instance, I have a couple down by the lake. Ooh, is that a Bigfoot sneaking up on them?
Yes, make it a Bigfoot. It's your painting. You can do what you want.
Oh.
What's his favorite color red for the blood when it tears the person apart? It's not brick red. Brick red is more a couple of hours later after the blood is dry.
It's a little old. Oh, look, he's dragging them into the lake.
Wants to clean them up before taking them back to his den. Little raccoon-like.
Bob Ross, Bigfoot. Anyways, Kev, that's a little bizarre fantasy, But what do we have today in our cryptids and news and all the oddities segment?
We're going to go to some mysterious phenomena, which I can't believe we haven't covered this one, but it's pretty darn cool. The Nazca Lines.
Oh, yes. Yes, I'm familiar with them a little bit.
I think everyone has seen them. But I wasn't that familiar with them at all and how they were discovered and how you see them and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So we're going to talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, yeah, they're definitely strange, you know.
Yeah, so these are these lines, you know, they talk about them as lines because lines were first discovered. And then when they looked a little bit more, there's like 100 of these animal kind of sketches into the desert in Peru. So in the Peruvian desert in South America, there's over 100 of these animals and hundreds of geometric shapes. Mm-hmm. And then these lines too, like very, very straight lines. And some of them are, get this, Bill, 25 miles long.
Wow. Yeah, and you know what interested me about them when I had first seen them was everything seems to be very shallow. Like, how did they last so long?
It's inches. Like, so they basically made these lines in the ground, maybe an inch thick and like 10 to 12 inches wide.
Uh-huh.
And when they try to make them straight, they are very straight. You know,
right,
like
right.
They're done with a straight edge.
Almost like they had a, I'm just drawing a blank, like a surveyor's instrument to lay it out, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And we'll get to that. But what's really amazing, too, so these drawings and geometric, or I should say these animals, like one of the most famous ones is this giant spider.
Mm-hmm.
That's like a perfectly drawn, perfectly symmetrical, like tarantula.
Mm-hmm.
That's hundreds of yards wide and long. So giant.
Yeah.
And these things, you know, they cover hundreds of square miles.
Yeah, that is the amazing thing. You know, it makes me wonder, I wonder if there's any relationship between this type of phenomena and crop circle phenomena.
Well, I mean, these are ancient.
Yeah.
So that's the next part I'm getting to.
Okay.
So, you know, they originally thought that this was part of the Incas civilization. And then they started to date these lines and drawings, and they span from 300 BC to 800 AD.
So they actually predate
the Incas.
So there was a continuum, though, of these lines being done for a long period of time. You're talking almost 1,000 years.
Yeah, more than 1,000 years.
Wow.
So now they think it's by the people, the Nazca people.
Okay.
Right? So this was a civilization that was there. And, I mean, it's super amazing, right? So that they're this old. And they weren't really discovered until the 1930s.
Didn't somebody first see them by doing a flyover of the area and realize what was underneath them?
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
I thought I remembered hearing that somewhere.
But it gets better than that, Bill.
Okay.
So they were reported on, I got to find my date here, they were first published in a book in 1553, where someone described the lines as trail markers. So I don't think they actually saw the animals and stuff like that, you know, because they could have been just walking along and saw the lines.
Right.
But how they were really discovered here in the 30s is super interesting. There was a guy named Toribio Zesby, and he was an archaeologist, and he wasn't there, though, to look at the lines. He was there to look at mummies in the Peruvian desert. And I didn't know this until I started looking at these lines, that they're the oldest mummies in the world. We always think of them as being in Egypt, but they're actually here in the Peruvian desert.
Wow.
And they're 7,000 years old.
Wow. That is
amazing.
And
it's pretty cool. Like, they're dressed in these, like, ponchos with very colorful animal scenes and stuff like that on the ponchos.
It must be the best that they had at the time, and they dressed the dead in them, you know, like ascending off, you know?
100%. So this guy, Zesby, he's out there in the desert, and he discovers these mummies. So, you know, he's on top of the world, right, in his thoughts, mm-hmm. right? Wow, look at this. I discover all these mummies. They're 7,000 years old. And then he takes a break one day. Get this, like, luckiest guy in the world. He hikes up the hill to have a little siesta, and he looks down, and he can't believe what he sees. But he sees some of these animals carved into the surface of the desert.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Just luck, pure chance.
Pure luck.
You know?
Yeah. And he thinks he's seeing things. And then he sees, no, this is for real. So he gets in touch with the Peruvian Air Force. And I mean, you know, Peruvian Air Force back there, they show a picture of them flying this single engine plane. It looks a little bit like Charles Lindbergh's Spirit of St. Louis.
Uh-huh.
And they go up flying around and they see all of these symbols.
Wow.
You know, like, he's just on a hillside and can see one or two, and he sees these lines more than the animals.
Right. And they just start chasing them around like connected dots. And wow, there's another
exactly.
one over here. Wow, there's one out here.
100%.
Amazing, so, though, that nobody, obviously they had at least an airplane, and nobody had flown over there before to make this discovery.
No, I guess because it's in the middle of the desert, you know, so no real reason to fly over it, right? Nothing going on.
Well, even somebody else with area knowledge having climbed up the hill and seen what was below, which is kind of weird, you know?
It is weird, but...
Wow.
You know...
So what happened after the discovery?
Well, then they started to try to figure out where they came from.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and initially, you know, it was kind of like, well, aliens, you know, aliens did it, right? Because there's one that looks a little bit like a spaceman and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
But what they learned later on is that some of these lines lined up exactly with some of the fault lines underground, which is kind of shocking. You know, like, you're talking about a straight line that's 25 miles long,
mm-hmm.
and it lines up precisely with the fault line under the ground.
Almost as if they had a way of determining where they were. Maybe they were marking them out like we would have a yield sign or a stop sign or danger or, you know.
Right. Well, what they think is, that's definitely a solid theory. What they think is that they were using it, because remember, it's a desert.
Yeah.
And that the Nazcan people figured out that there were these water locations, like wells,
mm-hmm.
along the fault lines.
Oh.
And they were using it so that they could mark where the water would be found.
Oh.
And that's why it went on for so long. Right? Because it was their survival dependent on it. Like, you got to mark where you're going to find the water. And then a theory that's not completely proven out, but makes sense, is that they actually named some of the water locations, you know, like spider or monkey or parrot, and they would mark them with a drawing of that animal.
Oh, that's interesting. So that kind of goes back to my thinking of a sign, like an indicator for something.
Exactly.
Because even if you mark the fault lines precisely, however they did that, I was going to say, why a picture of a freaking tarantula or, you know, a goat or whatever, you know?
Yeah, and I mean, it's like a hummingbird, you know, like they're all different creatures and critters.
Yeah. And they go on for, what'd you say, like 100 square miles?
Hundreds of square miles.
Wow.
You know, and this is an ancient civilization.
Well, do we know what happened to the Nazcas?
No, I don't.
Yeah. I wonder, because it seemed like they were around for a long period of time, and then their civilization just kind of diminished.
Yeah. Now, it's pretty interesting. Let's get back to how they did this or at least what the lines really are.
Right.
So it's pretty interesting. They would basically remove the pebbles and stuff that are on the surface of the desert, and it would leave a different color of dirt exposed.
Okay.
So it's very shallow. But the fact is that in this desert, because there's very little rain, not a lot of wind, et cetera, that these drawings stick around basically forever.
It's hard to believe, isn't it, when you think of another desert location like Egypt, where the sands just buried things, you know?
Yeah, and it's blowing across the Atlantic, you know, like it comes across in hurricanes and stuff like that.
Yep.
Right from Africa.
Mm-hmm.
So
really,
yeah,
amazing. And they're still there. Basically, they don't look any different than I would imagine they almost looked when they created them.
Exactly.
That's the mind-blowing thing. All right, so you don't get much rain, you don't get much wind, but we're talking a couple of thousand years.
Yeah.
Close
and,
to it.
And it's also, they say, because it's a constant climate.
Mm-hmm.
So the trifecta of windless, very dry, and this constant climate basically preserves the lines.
Yeah. Amazing, man. You know, really amazing. And look, we have places where dinosaur footprints have been laid bare through time. And they've been sitting there now for a long time till somebody walks up on it and says, hey, look, here's a freaking dinosaur footprint. You know, originally they were covered, but it's a different set of circumstances. They were covered, but now they're open, and they're not wearing away. They're just in the right environment to just sit there and be preserved, you know?
100%, yeah.
Weird, man. The Nazca lines.
Yeah, and you have, like, whales. You have what they call a giant astronaut. It looks a bit like an astronaut. Mm-hmm. They have a condor, a hummingbird, a giant tree with roots in that. The spider, I think, is the most famous one.
Yeah. Yeah.
Super cool, though. But they do look a little bit, getting back to your point, they look a little bit like crop circles. But they're actually, you know, kind of etched into the ground.
Yeah. It's just a different thing. But it's always funny to me, like, even when we talk about these animal depictions attached to these lines, first of all, they're so massive that you could really only tell what they were from being above them.
Yeah.
So there really would be no great benefit to creating this giant spider or this super huge hummingbird that even this archaeologist couldn't tell what they were until he had gone up in elevation to take a break or just to look around.
Yeah, he hiked up the hill and took a look.
Right. From ground level, you didn't know you were looking at a big spider.
Exactly.
It was almost like worthless, you know?
Right.
So were they going up? Maybe they were being supervised from on high when they were making them to create the designs, you know? You know, like some type of group was above them, telling them, going back and forth, telling them how to lay it out or what to do, you know?
Yep.
But also 100%. Interesting how those initial very straight lines were following faults where water could be found.
Yeah, I don't know how they did that.
Yeah. Right. Some of the technology going back is just it boggles the mind what they knew, what they didn't know. But, you know, listen, human beings all have brains. And with whatever you have at any given time, there were some really smart people in those groups.
Yep.
And look, not everybody is Nikola Tesla, but, you know, he was one amongst us who had an incredible mind to think and engineer and devise things right in his brain that he could then put on paper and they worked. So, you know, I am sure there were some really smart people in the Nazcas, in the Mayans, And you could just go down the list through history that had an edge on the others. They may have not had tools and things or technology to work with at the time, but they were trying to figure out how to do it.
Yep.
You know, and leading other people along the way to assist them in doing what they wanted to do, you know?
100%.
Kind of weird, Kev. The Nazca Lines.
It's super cool. And, I mean, I think it's super cool that the guy had discovered all of these mummies, these 7,000-year-old mummies, and then goes to take a break and hikes up the hill and looks down and starts to see this stuff.
Yeah, now, where are some of these mummies seen today? Do we know?
I don't know where they house them, mm-hmm. you know, which museum. I'm guessing it's probably in Peru, you know, in a national museum.
Yeah. Yeah. Funny. Mummification, huh?
Yeah.
Mummification. Interesting. Well, you know, for people that are new to the podcast, you're probably wondering, what is all this stuff? I thought this was Bigfoot Terror in the Woods. And it is. But we do a segment in the beginning of the show called Cryptids in the News and Other Oddities. And we will just about... Kev is snooping down and hunting down all kinds of strange things. And we get a lot of input from you, our listeners, as well. And many of you know we've taken your ideas and brought them to the table. So,
and sometimes I do cover Bigfoot.
Sometimes. Some excellent Bigfoot. And in fact, Kev loves old Bigfoot accounts.
Old Bigfoot. I like those gray Bigfoot that walk with a cane and a walker.
Dag nabbit.
Actually, I like the old accounts.
Yeah, yeah. So, folks, Kev, how can the people get us if they want to send something?
You go to BigfootTerrorInTheWoods.com and say, contact us, and send us an email. And we may read your email online, too, or on the podcast. And we answer a lot of them, and Bill calls you. You know, if you tell him that you want to talk to him about an account or something like that,
mm-hmm.
you probably even get a phone call.
That's right. From a movie star.
Exactly.
Genuine movie star.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know the guy. And I can tell you it's good that he's on a podcast instead of on the film, because you may not want to look at him.
Yeah, kind of like a Bigfoot.
Oh, my goodness. Well, Kev, I've got an account here, and I'll get into it, but we're going to have a little discussion about this later because as I was just kind of reviewing it, I said, you know, I got about a half a dozen of these, including my friend Phillips' sighting on Fondy Mountain. I think that's in Kentucky or West Virginia. Let me get into this, and we'll have a little discussion about what these good old boys ran across here. So this encounter was told to me by a fellow named Jake Ferris, like the Ferris wheel, a hunter from the state of Arkansas. And this is what Jake and his hunting partner experienced while trying to take down a hog or two in August of 2015, not all that long ago. My recollection of the day was that of it being an extremely hot and humid week, during which we had decided to go out early on a Saturday morning to try and bag a hog. The day before, it was still in the 90s, well after the sun had set. And when Perry and I had met in the morning, things hadn't improved much, with it still being hot as the sun was rising. We made our way over to a wooded area which we frequented in southeastern Arkansas and began to work our way through the fields and trees. By 10 o'clock in the morning, we hadn't seen but one small porker, and I was so hot that my clothes were sticking to me. I could actually feel water in my boots from the perspiration. Perry and I decided to come back later in the day and try to catch the last 45 minutes or so of the twilight in the hope of some of these hogs coming out to root. So we entered the area at about 7 p.m. It was still sweltering hot, but we knew that even a hot pig needs to eat. There's some good words there. So eventually, nothing like a hot pig.
Now, where are they, Bill?
All he lets me into is southeastern Arkansas.
Okay. Arkansas.
Arkansas. So he's saying, like, pigs got to eat whether it's hot or not, so they're hoping they're going to come out. So we entered the, I read that, we had positioned ourselves behind some tall, wheat-like grass, overlooking a field of the same, which was graded on an upwards angle, meeting a wood line about a football field's distance from where we sat. We knew there wouldn't be much time in regards to having enough light to hunt, and we were hoping that something would happen quickly if it was going to happen at all. Now, leading up to what I'm about to say, I must tell you that we had been sitting for about 20 minutes and had seen nothing up until that point in time that we came into the field. Now, this is a critical point which will come into play shortly. So, as I said, in our minds, nothing was in the field, and we were in wait for hogs to come out of the trees into the field. Now, I don't mean to be repetitive, but for the sake of what happened, I think I need to. It was then that three or four hogs began to meander down into the field, all of them disappearing from view, concealed by the tall grass. And Perry and I began to creep and crawl to our right, hoping to get them back in view. At the time, we had no idea how tall the grass was on the other side, for if we did, we would have positioned ourselves in a different manner from the get-go. I now believe that the grass which they had entered was close to 4 feet tall or thereabouts, and they were completely obscured from our view. About 100 feet to the right-hand side of where they had entered, we had noticed some grass beginning to move and sway, which apparently was being done by something else moving through it. Keeping in mind what I said about us having seen nothing enter into the field beforehand. Pigs don't generally run around, especially in the heat. And none of the pigs we had seen enter would have made it to this area where the grass was moving so quickly. There was a sudden flash of dark color visible above and through the height of the grass, which looked like the arched back of a huge dark boar, which was followed by a bunch of grunts and squeals that ended in total silence. During this brief point in time, several of the hogs we had seen enter went running back into the woods. And I had initially thought that a large boar was in the grass resting and had attacked at least one of those that had entered in an act of aggression. As it turns out, this was not the case at all. Rising up out of the field and now standing fully erect before us at about 75 yards was a Bigfoot of mammoth proportions. He was standing at a side angle to us as darkness was beginning to take hold of the area and was holding a large sow by the jaws with one jaw in each hand, splaying them wide open to a point where they were virtually horizontal, apparently having been done to keep the hog from biting or snapping at it. The hog was still writhing as it hung with its mouth broken wide open, as the Bigfoot, while holding it with both hands, began to slam it up and down against the ground. We could hear it being whacked against the ground by the Bigfoot, and he had literally slammed the life out of it, tucked it under its arm, and walked away. This hog, had to have been at least 175 to 200 pounds. and the Bigfoot was manhandling it like you or I would fluff a pillow. Perry and I were speechless, saying nothing to each other as we watched this event unfold. This Bigfoot had to have been either sleeping in the grass or lying in wait for the hog's arrival prior to our getting to the location. Thankfully, we weren't talking coming in, or we would have certainly warned it of us being there. Although we couldn't see anything, it seemed to have moved about 50 feet on what had to have been the ground level to quickly get to the hog. And how the hog could have escaped is a complete mystery, seeing the size of this Bigfoot. They must be able to move like a tarantula across the ground, prevailing upon the victim before they can react. It stood at about 7 feet tall and was barrel-shaped, with its width at its knees being equivalent to its width at the chest. It was very dark in color with gray-colored tips on much of its hair, which made me think that it was older, making the comparison to what happens to humans as we age. Its head was almost forced forward in what appeared to be a very uncomfortable posture by the massive muscles mounting up behind it. Never once during this whole spectacle did it turn to look in our direction, which further emphasized it had no idea that we were there. Perry and I were both avid hunters, both regionally as well as in other states. We had heard all the stories, as many have, and yet we had never seen nor heard anything to suggest these creatures were real, with the tables having been turned that day in Arkansas. Amazing, huh?
Yeah, big beast.
Now,
eating pigs.
I think the first account that I had put down on paper, I called Along Came a Spider. And it was also a couple of guys out hunting for hogs who saw something moving along the grass that looked like an army helmet in their description, sticking above the grass, like a dome moving.
Yep.
And this thing eventually launched an attack, but they saw it going across an opening in the grass before it tucked back into the grass and launched its attack. And they said that it was walking like a spider.
Like, I remember that
the
one.
The knees were like buckled, or the lower legs were buckled. Now, back to our buddy Phil in Kentucky. When Phil had his Bigfoot encounter as a security guard at a mining operation on Fondee Mountain, they had a place that they coincidentally called the Boneyard. And the Boneyard had a light pole in it, and along the side of this Boneyard clearing was some porta-potties and dumpsters for the miners. And Phil said the Boneyard was a place where they kept some operational equipment, but a lot of stuff that was broken in case they needed a piece of something or other. They could, you know, cannibalize it off for something that was broken and maybe keep things going, you know. And he was out there at night with a shotgun and saw something crawling around on the ground. Now, he initially told me that, look, I'm an old mountain boy. I know what's out there and what's not out there. And he said, my first inclination was bear, but my mind and eyes were telling me something else. Like, yeah, bear, but it's not a bear. Because, in other words, what else could be big and dark and crawling around low to the ground like that other than a black bear? And eventually this thing stood up just like these guys saw it stand up, and they realized this ain't no bear and it's no dark-colored boar or anything else. It's a Bigfoot.
Yep.
So these things, you know, I had another cat. You know, I'm reviewing all of these stories to put in my regional books. There was another count out of Florida. I think it was Florida, where these people came across a Bigfoot that apparently was sleeping next to a downed tree. And they saw a little bit of the outline of the body sticking above the tree, thinking, like, what is that? You know, it looks like fur. So something is lying down over there. And then this thing got wind of them being there, jumped, looked like it was going to attack them for a moment, and then it just ran away. So these things do go down on the ground. You know, they lay down, they crawl.
Well, we've said that a while ago, Bill, where, you know, we're always looking for them, like, standing up. But we don't, like, crouch down to the ground and look to see if they're laying horizontally under some bushes.
Correct. Or up a tree.
Yep. We don't look up either.
No. And I have accounts, like, where the eagles gather, where that one was robbing nests and the ravens were flying over it.
Yep.
I got a couple out of Northern California from the Redwood Forest area where people saw them up in the trees.
Yep.
So, you know, look, they're strong. They have big hands. They got big feet. They're certainly in the line of what we would call some type of primate type animal as far as their appearance, right? Yeah. They're strong as all get out, so climbing a tree or hanging onto a tree is nothing for them.
Yeah, not a difficult task.
I wouldn't think so, you know. And here we have another account of guys. Now, I've been saying for a long time, well, we talked about Neil, right, down in Clay County in Georgia with a few different accounts happening around that area in the soybean and peanut farms, cotton. With the hog population growing and growing around southeast, central, I don't know where it really extends, but definitely in the southeast. You want to talk about a robust food source. I mean, come on, man. You know, so you got deer, but my God, these pigs come through. I would think that a pig.
Well, yeah, I mean, you look at eastern North Carolina, where I am, we have bear, a lot of bear.
Uh-huh.
Which people are like, how could you have bear? Because we got a lot of pigs. And I don't mean the pigs on the farm. Like, you know, we make a lot of bacon here.
Yeah, yeah.
That's true. But we have a lot of wild pigs, too.
Yeah, and the way these things travel around, I would think they'd be a much easier ambush than a deer.
Yeah. And you know what they say about pigs, Bill?
What's that?
They're good eating.
That's right. I never had a pig I didn't like.
Bacon's good.
I like to gnaw on their little hooves. Because if I don't whittle my teeth down, I grow fangs.
And bacon's good.
Oh, man. You know, speaking of bacon being good, I went to my little diner the other day run by these El Salvadorian people. And I ordered extra bacon.
And when you went in, did you say, bacon's good?
Next time I'm going to go in there.
Next time I go and see you, you got to take me there. And you'll be like, this is my brother, KJ, blah, blah, blah. And I'll just say, bacon's good.
Yeah, and then I'll say, Ernesto, tocino es bueno. That's bacon, man.
Tocino. He'll start laughing. I'll be like, bacon's good. Be like, your brother say anything else other than that? And you're like, no. And don't let him use your telephone either.
Why do his eyes look that way?
That's just how they are.
You know, I'm surprised because there's a lot of people around right now putting on these colored, like, contact lenses. Have you seen them?
Oh, yeah.
Like, there's this lady I knew that had brown eyes, and she was staring me in the eye couple of months back, and now they were bright blue, like electric blue, you know?
Yep.
And I'm like, I didn't say anything, you know, but I was like,
You didn't say, hey, you freak.
Yeah. But now I'm thinking, I wonder if some weirdos out there are going to get the black-eyed children eyes or something, you know? Because they used them in some of these monster movies.
Now we're cooking with gas.
Woo. Whoa, what happened to WJ?
Let me borrow your telephone.
Oh, my God. Well, Kev, that's it, man. A little Nazca lines and a freak.
And a little Bigfoot pig hunting.
Yeah, jaw-breaking Bigfoot. Can you imagine?
All right, well, we got some good listener mail, Bill.
Go ahead.
And we're going to start out with one of my favorite emails of all time, but it just came in.
Okay.
So he says, hi. Well, it's from Luke from Oregon. And he says, hey, my name's Luke, and I'm a high school teacher in Eastern Oregon.
Wow.
I teach at a small magnet school that focuses on experiential education.
Hmm.
Twice a year, we get to pause our normal course schedule and teach one-week elective courses called intensives.
What are they called again, Kev?
Intensives.
Intensives,
like, you know,
okay.
You're intense, you know.
Yeah.
You know, with my crazy voice. I have hatched an idea to teach a Sasquatching course that would help students unravel the mystery of Sasquatch. And potentially scare the bejesus out of them. I added that part.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that belongs in there.
But, you know, Luke was thinking about that.
Yeah.
I plan to teach the course in early May this year, so coming up.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a Sasquatch enthusiast, and I'm rather well-read on the topic. During the course, I'm wanting to share encounter stories that Bill has written about, and in an effort to share stories that are closer to home in Oregon, I was wondering if you kept records of where your stories took place. And if so, would you share the ones that have happened in Oregon with me?
Hmm.
I have two copies of your books and one audiobook too, but if you have a list for me, I'd like to purchase more to share. I also have a sighting story of my dad's back in 2006 that I could possibly share with you. It wasn't a long one, but it was this event that started my interest in Sasquatch. Thank you for your time, Luke. So how cool is that, Bill? Because you've covered, he probably hasn't caught up to it yet, the fact that you're putting these republications together that are by region.
Yeah. Now, let me say this, and I hope Luke is listening. Luke, reach back out to me again via email with your phone number. I am in the process of organizing all of the accounts in 12 volumes into regional books. And I have a complete list of the accounts in Oregon right now. So I could tell you the name of the account and what volume it's in, and then you're on your way. Okay, so you could dig right into what's going on in Oregon. I think there's like 30 of them over there.
Yeah.
So I'd be happy to share them with you. And then all you have to do is just go out and buy 12 books. And the 12, well, you can't buy 12.
Yeah, and if you buy a dozen, they come in a box.
Right, you buy a dozen. Yeah, they're going to come in a box, an Amazon cardboard
box. It's a cardboard box gift set.
Yeah, a brown plain cardboard with packaging tape on it.
But it has a big smiley face on it.
I don't know if it has a smiley face.
Oh, yeah, Amazon smiley face.
Might have a picture of Jeff Bezos on it saying, thanks for the cash.
I don't think he says thanks for the cash. Just saying.
But yeah, Luke, you reach out to me and I'll help you out, brother.
All right. Two more emails, Bill. The first one, we don't normally mention the person's last name, but we don't normally get emails from the famous Fox Mulder. of X-Files.
Yeah, Fox Mulder.
So Fox writes in, who were the green children of Woolpit? So I think this is Fox. You know, he's not known for a lot of words. You know that Fox Mulder of X-Files.
Kev, I have
to. But I think he's given me a tip.
Let me tell you something, Kev. You're not going to believe this. I never saw a single episode of X-Files.
You are missing out, brother.
Not one.
You are missing out. You got to start watching them right away.
Are they still around?
Oh, yeah. You can find them.
You could find them.
YouTube.
YouTube. Okay. Go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt
you. I'm just saying, man, you are going to love the X-Files.
And by the way, bacon's good.
Scully and Mulder, good.
Go ahead, man.
Yeah, so he gives us a tip there, Fox Mulder, on the Green Children of Woolpit, which I'm going to cover one of these times. But these are some kids that wandered into a village in a place called Woolpit in the UK, and they were green.
Wow.
And that's all I'm going to say for now.
Okay.
So stay tuned and we'll get there. Maybe they were baby leprechauns. I don't know. Maybe they had some kind of poisoning that turned them green. I don't know, but they were green.
They were green.
All right. And our last email comes in from John. And John writes, I have on more than one occasion looked at something I could not explain in the woods of the Cascades in Washington. From broken trees, bone piles, things that appeared to be a Bigfoot nest, while having a feeling of being watched, and a personal encounter. The personal encounter involved three witnesses. The experience was in the late 70s, and the last encounter I had was in 2011. And I was in our camp, and it got a lot of attention. I don't go into this remote area unarmed ever. Hmm. And by the way, I listened to your interview on Coast to Coast, Mr. Sheehan. Bigfoot is out there.
Yeah. You better believe it. And I ain't Fox Mulder or Fox Smoldering or anything else.
So did you talk to this John yet or not?
I haven't. I reached out to John, and it's another one of these people that just never got back to me.
Well, yeah, we're all busy.
You know, but, you know, I encourage everybody, you know, if you've seen something, say something. And I feel like I'm beating a dead horse because I don't know how many people I reach out to that say they got something to talk about, and it doesn't happen. So I don't know what's going on with that.
That's all right. Just beat that horse.
Just beat it some more.
Beat that horse.
But, yeah, if you've seen something, say something. Go to our website, like Kev said before. Hit the contact button. Tell me who you are. Leave your phone number. If you can, leave me some times you're available. And we'll hit back and forth until we get together. That's basically what happens, you know?
Good deal.
So,
all right, Bill. Well, that's it for this week. Great podcast. And folks, if you're out there, give us a 5-star review on your favorite podcast player. It's the only means we have of attracting new listeners to the podcast. And by getting new listeners, we're able to maintain our weekly schedule and keep bringing you some quality content.
Yeah, and by the way, folks, I usually never say this, but if you go out and buy my books, take the time to leave a quality review for the books. Don't leave it up to somebody else who's whistling Dixie and has more time on their hands than they know what to do with. And they probably don't really believe in Bigfoot, so they get a little critical. Mm. I mean, I'd like to see some really golden reviews coming from some of the listeners that are happy about what's going on here and the work being put forth to create these books and gather together these accounts all into one place where you could read them, ponder them, and look at them again and again, you know, and that's what this is all about, you know, so leave good reviews for the podcast, for the books, for the audio books. And Don't leave it up to somebody else to do it. You do it. So that's
all right.
That's it, Kev, man. It was a pretty good, interesting stuff there, man. Sometimes I like these little cryptid and oddity things that you come up with. You know, they're little nuggets hidden out. There's so much strange stuff going on. Oh, by the way, Kev, Skinwalker's coming on April 23rd, new season.
Ooh.
Yeah, I just saw that the other day. New season.
I'm ready for a little more Skinwalker Ranch.
Yeah, yeah, me too, man. And then, of course, I think they'll probably follow that up with Beyond Skinwalker again. I hope they do.
Yeah, they will.
So that's an excellent. I love that stuff, you know.
Yeah.
Anyways, folks, hope you enjoyed what we're serving up today. And remember, if you should be walking around in the woods of southeastern Arkansas, Pennsylvania, the Allegheny Trail, wherever, you best remember one thing, my friends. Always carry more gun than you think you're going to need. Sleep tight.